89.9 FM, Madison.
The time is now 6 o'clock. Welcome to WORT's local news for Monday, April 8th, 2024. I'm your host, Rachel Fields.
And I'm your host, Sam Swartz. In tonight's news,
Madisonians joined the solar eclipse fervor.
President Biden visited Madison again today and announced his new plan to provide student debt relief.
And in the second half, the latest from Wisconsin's uninstructed campaign, a retrospective on the Colfax massacre, and two movie reviews.
All these and more on tonight's news, but first we'll go live to the BBC for some news from around the world.
Hello, I'm David Harper with the BBC News. A total eclipse of the sun that swept across a broad swathe of North America has ended. Tens of millions of sky gazers had gathered along its route in Mexico, Canada and the United States to view the spectacle. Many were treated to a breathtaking display of the sun's outer atmosphere, or corona, which is usually obscured by its own intense glare. Helena Humphrey was watching from Lake Erie in Ohio.
The word that people have used time and time again is awesome, but awesome in the truest sense of the word, inspiring awe. We really lucked out. We had that bright blue sky and then that fantastic moment of totality. A lot of people say that it's difficult to find the words to describe it. For me, it was mystical, mesmerizing, magical. 99% of Americans got to see partial or total eclipse, and I think that just goes to show that this is something that is a unifying moment that connects us, but a true natural phenomenon.
27 people have gone on trial in connection with the Panama Papers scandal. The affair, which began with a huge leak of documents 8 years ago, highlighted how tax havens have been used by the rich and powerful to hide their wealth. Ione Wells reports.
The leak implicated more than 100 politicians, including heads of state and government, billionaires and sports stars. The leak showed how clients of the now defunct Panamanian law firm called Mossack Fonseca were able to launder money, dodge sanctions, and avoid tax. If the founders of the firm are found guilty, they could face up to 12 years in prison. The law firm has since closed down, but its founders have claimed neither they, the firm, or its employees were involved in unlawful acts.
The United States has again urged Israel not to attack the overcrowded town of Rafah in southern Gaza. This comes just hours after the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said a date had been set for the operation against Hamas, but he didn't reveal when. A White House spokesman said a full-scale assault would enormously harm civilians. More than 1 million Palestinians are sheltering in Rafah. Donald Trump has resisted pressure from within his own party to back a nationwide ban on abortion ahead of November's presidential election. The Republican candidate said it was up to individual states to decide. Speaking before boarding a plane, Vice President Kamala Harris criticized Donald Trump for taking credit for overturning Roe v. Wade, a long-standing decision in which a woman's right to have an abortion was protected by the U.S. Constitution.
He yet again said he's proudly responsible for overturning Roe v. Wade. And one has to ask, proudly responsible that 1 in 3 women of reproductive age now live in a state with an abortion ban? Proudly responsible that doctors and nurses can now be jailed in some states for life for providing care? Proudly responsible that states have passed bans with no exception even for rape or incest?
World News from the BBC. A study of hundreds of patients who'd been seriously ill with long COVID suggests some people's immune system remains overactive long after the initial infection has cleared. Those with the condition have evidence of inflammation in their blood, which might provide clues for their treatment. The study conducted in Britain found the presence of certain proteins increased the risk of symptoms such as fatigue in people who were sick enough to need hospital treatment. Tracy Evans spent several weeks on a ventilator 3 years ago.
I have fatigue so bad, even just changing a pillowcase on a bed, it's breathless. I can't walk far, even to a local shop, which isn't far, I can't walk. I'm tired all the time. I have shooting pains all over my body. I've got really bad brain fog.
The Southern African grouping SADC says it's ready to take action against anyone threatening its troops in the Democratic Republic of Congo after a deadly mortar attack. Three Tanzanian soldiers were killed and three others were hurt during the attack on a military base in the Sake in North Kivu province on Saturday. Russia's ambassador to the United Nations nuclear watchdog says his country has called an emergency meeting to discuss what he said were Ukrainian attacks on the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant. The Russian-occupied facility is near to the front line of fighting, and both sides regularly accuse each other of shelling the site. Yesterday, the IAEA confirmed that a drone had exploded on one of the plant's domes, but hadn't caused any damage. Police in Uganda have questioned members of a traditional performance group suspected of insulting President Yoweri Museveni. They were detained in Kampala after someone was heard saying, "Leave the microphone, we are tired," during a wedding anniversary speech by the 79-year-old president. It's not clear what charge, if any, the group might be facing. Human rights campaigners have accused Mr. Museveni of becoming increasingly intolerant of criticism. He's been in power for nearly four decades. BBC News.
This is Sam Swartz and Rachel Fields with your local news coming to you live from the WORT studios on Bedford Street in beautiful downtown Madison. Happy Eclipse. Here are your headlines tonight.
President Joe Biden touched down in Madison today, and he chose Madison College as the site to announce his new plan for student debt forgiveness. Under the proposal, more than 4 million student loan borrowers could see their debt completely wiped out. 10 million more student borrowers could get thousands in relief. Speaking at the MATC gym, Biden characterized student loans as, quote, crushing. Characterizing a college degree as a ticket to the middle class, he said the price of that ticket is, quote, much too expensive. The new plan is Biden's second shot at resolving student debt, a high-profile item also promised in his 2020 presidential run. The U.S. Supreme Court knocked down his first attempt last year, which would have canceled up to $10,000 in federal student loan debt for borrowers earning less than $125,000 per year. Biden's trip is part of a series of visits to Wisconsin, one of a handful of battleground states expected to play a deciding role come November. It was Biden's third trip to Wisconsin just this year, and Vice President Kamala Harris visited Madison on a trip highlighting labor initiatives last month. Today's trip comes a week after Wisconsin's spring election, where over 14% of voters in the Democratic primary opted to vote uninstructed, largely as a protest of Biden's handling of foreign policy in Gaza. Protesters came out in person to Madison College today, too, objecting to the continuing sale of arms to Israel.
Wisconsin Governor Tony Evers vetoed a Republican-backed bill today that would have rolled back requirements for younger teenagers to get work permits. The bill introduced last year by Republican lawmakers would have done away with a requirement for 14 and 15-year-olds to get work permits, a process that also requires parental sign-off. The Republican lawmakers behind the bill say that it gets rid of red tape that slows down hiring. But Evers, who vetoed the bill at a conference of the State Council of Machinists, said the bill wasn't a serious proposal for his Republican counterparts to address generational statewide issues. He pointed to recent U.S. Department of Labor statistics that show a recent increase in child labor law violations. 16 and 17-year-olds already don't need a work permit under a 2017 change signed into law by former Governor Scott Walker.
Former Madison School Board President and Madison mayoral hopeful Gloria Reyes is taking a job in Minnesota, reports Madison 365. Gloria Reyes has been named the next deputy county manager of the safety and justice team in Minnesota's Ramsey County, which contains St. Paul. The unit of government oversees more than 1,000 employees and manages a nearly $160 million budget. Reyes currently works as the deputy director of the Dane County Department of Human Services. She previously served as Madison police officer, deputy mayor, and head of Briar Patch Youth Services. She's slated to begin her new role in mid-May.
Madison's alternative response service, CARES, has steadily grown since its first launch as a small pilot program over 2.5 years ago. The program dispatches a paramedic from the fire department and crisis mental health worker from the Journey Mental Health. CARES teams only respond to certain nonviolent calls for service. CARES workers have responded to roughly 5,000 incidents since the launch in fall of 2021. And today, CARES launched its third team of crisis workers in a move intended to keep up with the weekday demand. The CARES 3 team is on duty from noon to 10 p.m. Monday through Friday, working out of a former fire station on Fish Hatchery Road.
A Madison alder is denying recently surfaced allegations of domestic abuse as other members of the Madison Common Council offer messages of support to survivors. Madison alder Charles Miadze, who represents the city's north side, pushed back against allegations in a message to constituents yesterday. In an email, he called recently surfaced allegations, quote, entirely baseless, defamatory, and without merit, unquote. That comes after two romantic partners of the alder have come forward in recent days alleging physical and emotional abuse in their relationships. The allegations have circulated on social media and were published by Madison 365. In his message, Alder Miadze pointed to his advocacy for causes like Safe Harbor, which works to support domestic abuse survivors. Safe Harbor tells Madison 365 that Miadze has not had contact with the organization since fall 2023 and did not follow up on their requests for assistance since then. At the same time, another contingent on the Madison Common Council is sending their own acknowledgement of support. And they say despite calls for the council to remove Miadze from office, there is not much they can do. Under state law, alders can only be removed after a finding of cause directly related to an alder's actions once elected. But the allegations describe incidents that they say took place before Miadze was elected.
Madison's spring planting season began today, and the Urban Forestry Division says they'll be planting 1,374 new trees along city streets this month. Soon, the young trees will be among the city's nearly 100,000 planted along more than 700 miles of Madison streets. Another round of planting will come this fall.
A new music venue is set to open in downtown Madison this June. The Gamma Ray Bar is slated to replace the small venue space on West Main Street, just off the Capitol Square. It's the project of performer and bar manager Kevin Wilmot II, who tells Tone Madison the new venue is aimed at being a safe, inclusive space with an emphasis on community. When it opens, it will be one of two music clubs independently owned and run by a Black owner. Previous incarnations of the space have included the short-lived Barley Pop Live and The Frequency, which operated for about a decade. Before that, the space was also Adair's Lounge, and before that, the Slipper Club, which closed in 2006. Opening night is set for June 1st with karaoke and a slate of local bands. It'll be DJed between sets by WORT's own Real Jaguar. Those were the headlines, and now on to the rest of today's top stories.
Today's partial solar eclipse began around 12:50 and lasted for about 2.5 hours. And while Madison wasn't within the path of totality, Madisonians still stepped outside to watch the skies, witnessing a rare moment as the wind died down and shadows became crescent-shaped. On campus, Library Mall was crawling with hundreds of students. A smaller group of amateur astronomers gathered on Observatory Hill to get a better view. News producer Faye Parks was there as the partial eclipse reached its peak at just after 2 p.m. this afternoon.
Are you guys students here? Are you a group of friends? Or are you in like a...
Yeah.
What brought you to this part of campus? I saw a lot of students gathered down by Library Mall.
Yeah, I kind of chose the spot. I used to live over on Lakeshore, and I've always loved the view of the lake from the observatory. And so I figured it'd just be a really nice spot to sit, get some breeze, and look up.
Mm-hmm. And did you guys notice any changes in weather as it started? Anything like that?
I swear it got colder.
Yeah,
I swear
it's
it
like
got
the
colder.
Sunlight went and then it just got colder. But it was also really windy, which felt very magical.
And did the birds stop singing? Did you notice anything like that?
I don't know about
nothing
that.
Yeah,
night,
yeah,
honestly,
like nothing too occultish. But
we definitely noticed the shadows getting a little more prominent.
Yeah.
And when it was, you know, eclipsing, we were messing with the shadows
yeah.
and saw the little moons. So that was really
mm-hmm.
fun. But.
Very cool.
And so do you guys have any classes today, or did this work out timing-wise?
Not for me, no. I emailed my professor and I was like, sorry, this is a rare opportunity, so I will not be here. And
she was so understanding.
Yeah.
Yeah, as you should.
Oh, so she said it was cool?
Yeah.
It was cool?
She was like, we'll probably leave class a few minutes early, too, to check it out. So,
oh, nice.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's just so nice to see everyone out together. Like,
yeah.
I feel like it was just a really wholesome, like, everyone together
yeah.
moment.
It's a beautiful day. We're
mm-hmm.
lucky the sun's shining. Yeah.
Just feel really lucky.
Yeah.
What's your full name?
Ian Bloom.
And what brings you here?
I'm here to watch the eclipse with my wife.
So what brought you to this specific spot in Madison to watch?
I mean, they call it Observatory Drive for a reason, so we're here to observe.
And have you ever seen an eclipse before?
No, not in person. I've seen it on TV, but first time in person.
And so this one, it won't be a total eclipse. Do you think it'll still be impactful to watch?
I think so, yeah. I mean, I think I read that the next one's not going to be for another 20 years. So might as well. I mean, 20 years from now, I'll be in my 60s, so.
Yeah. And what's the energy feel like here? Is it sort of exciting to be in a big group of people to watch it together?
Yeah, it does. I mean, it feels like we're a community. We're a part of something.
What's your full name?
My name is Chirag Gandhi.
Did you want to tell me what your thoughts are on the eclipse at all?
It was beautiful. I remember 2017 from my home where I watched it, and this was even more impressive. It was great to come here instead of watching it from home, because then you have all the people around here, and it's kind of makes it a fun, celebrative event, right?
So you made the trip down here just to watch it, is that right?
That is correct, yes. I headed over about 40 minutes back, then we walked over to Union South, came back over here and watched it along the way at different places. Some people had set up some telescopes, so it was beautiful to kind of take part in that as well. Through the telescope, it was just bigger. That was the main part, and you could see the spots on the sun, so that was kind of interesting to see. They had two different telescopes. One of them was adjusting along with the changing direction, so that was where I didn't even know that could happen, so that was kind of nice to understand. And the other one, they were manually adjusting, and they were both very good.
And have you noticed any changes to the environment since you started watching, the wind changing, that kind of thing?
I think it's even cold right now as I talk to you, so it's definitely cooler.
So what are your names?
I'm Isabel.
I'm Tasia.
So your professors just canceled classes. Is that for the whole time, for the whole day, or just for this hour?
For this hour, my professor canceled class, and then my other class, he kind of made it optional, and he was going to record it because he wanted us to go outside to look
at
it.
To be able to experience it.
Yeah.
I'm skipping class right now, so. Because I was like, you know what, I emailed my teacher, and she was like, you're going to be marked absent. I was like, all right, that's what's going to happen then. Yeah.
You know, you're not the first person I've heard who said they're not going to class, but most professors have been pretty cool with it.
Yeah.
So, did that surprise you?
I mean, her response was a little bit shocking, just because this is something that, I don't know when the next time we're going to be able to see this, if they say 44 or something.
Yeah, like 20 years.
And I don't know, I'm a big person of, like, skip class if it's something you're never going to see again or for a long time.
For WORT News, I'm Faye Parks.
For some time, a controversial oil pipeline in the Great Lakes region has been entangled in legal challenges and opposition. Native American advocates argue that the pipeline illegally crossed tribal lands, and they are speaking out against the latest phase of the project. Mike Moen of the Wisconsin News Connection has the latest.
Later this month, Indigenous leaders will speak before a United Nations panel about their ongoing concerns with a controversial oil pipeline in the Great Lakes region. Enbridge Energy's Line 5 operation is likely to come up when the Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues convenes in New York. Back in the Midwest, organizations like Earth Justice represent the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Chippewa. The tribe has been contesting Line 5 in Wisconsin as Enbridge seeks to reroute the pipeline. Earth Justice attorney Stephanie Sosi says the proposal is not an improvement in minimizing the effect on tribal lands.
The Bad River Band is already at a risk of an oil spill because the pipeline is going directly through their reservation, and the reroute, I mean, if you look at the map, it's basically hugging the reservation boundaries.
She says her team is preparing for litigation if permits for the reroute are issued. The tribe has previously filed lawsuits against Line 5 in an effort to shut it down, prompting the latest route plans. Similar cases have been active in Michigan. Enbridge argues the pipeline is a key source of energy and rejects claims and legal decisions that it's trespassing on tribal lands. On the Michigan side, opponents say they're worried about Enbridge's latest Line 5 plans to construct an oil tunnel beneath the Straits of Mackinac, a connecting waterway. The company says it would be safer than the existing pipeline section, but Native American Rights Fund attorney Wes Furlong says there's real concern about a worst-case scenario.
If a leak happened within that tunnel, it would cause a catastrophic failure, pumping crude oil into the Straits and into the Great Lakes.
He says pushing back against Line 5 aligns with calls to reduce the use of fossil fuels, citing their connection to climate change and the impact on treaty-reserved resources Midwest tribes rely on. First built in 1953, the pipeline can transport up to 23 million gallons of oil and natural gas liquids per day. This is Mike Moen for Wisconsin News Connection. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
The time right now is 6:20 p.m., and you're listening to the live local news right here on WORT.
President Biden visited Madison today, his third trip to Wisconsin since the start of this year, and he used his campaign stop at Madison College to announce a student debt relief plan. But this isn't the Biden administration's first attempt to do so. His original plan faced numerous legal challenges and was ultimately struck down in the Supreme Court last year. That plan had many supporters, including the Student Borrower Protection Center, a national nonprofit organization. Our news producer, Faye Parks, spoke to their director of advocacy and civil rights counsel, Kat Welbeck, to hear what's behind Biden's new plan.
Thank you for joining me, Kat.
Thanks so much for having me, Faye. I'm happy to be here.
So listeners understand, what are the impacts of student debt on the average American?
This is such a great question, and I think it's so important to talk about the broad effects of student debt. Already, there's a large burden for people in terms of thinking about that monthly student loan payment. That's one big piece, but also it has so many more effects on individual borrowers, their families, and larger communities. It inhibits people's ability to buy homes, people's ability to save, just, you know, for regular expenses, save for retirement. We've even heard stories about, you know, in research about student debt affecting people's mental health. You know, people delaying family formation because student debt is so stressful and burdensome. And so there really are these numerous economic effects of student debt that, you know, burden people in each and every month. But there are also these broader aspects of student debt that cut into wealth building and economic mobility that really harm not only borrowers, but also their communities as a whole.
So today, while in Madison, President Biden announced a new debt relief plan. So can you walk us through the plan's main points?
One really important note about this debt relief plan is last summer we saw the Supreme Court block President Biden's student debt relief plan where he used the HEROES Act authority to provide debt relief. That same day, the president announced, I'm going to use another pathway using the authority under the Higher Education Act to still provide broad debt relief for student loan borrowers. Today's announcement is really going through some of the contours of this plan that we're likely going to see as this formal rulemaking process concludes. So a lot of this is really going to benefit about 30 million student loan borrowers, but some parts of that, really big pieces, we hear a lot of stories about student loan borrowers making payments every single month, but they see their balances grow because of ballooning interest. So part of the plan is talking about waiving accrued and capitalized interest, especially for borrowers who see their balances grow, even though they're making payments every month. Similarly, if we recall when President Biden announced debt relief, he also announced a new income-driven repayment plan called SAVE, Saving on a Valuable Education. There are many people right now enrolled in this plan who are already seeing lower monthly payments, seeing that, you know, their interest is not ballooning every month. So we're already seeing people benefit from this more affordable payment plan. But one thing that this does too, similarly, it provides borrowers an opportunity to get a waiver for any amount of their balance that is greater than what they initially borrowed. So again, trying to address that ballooning interest. It also provides relief for people who've been in repayment for decades. We know a lot of stories about borrowers who've been in repayment 20 to 25 years. Also, there's some parts about providing relief for borrowers who have been defrauded by their schools, and then also a piece about borrowers who have experienced hardship. So we're going to get, again, more of the contours of that when we see the proposed rule, but really looking at borrowers who might be facing some sort of financial hardship because of student debt.
And so going back to that initial attempt that was struck down by the Supreme Court last year, what were the main issues from their perspective? Was it that he had overstepped his bounds and then this is a response to that? Can you explain that background?
One thing that's really important to note about the Supreme Court case is that what the court said is President Biden used an authority called the HEROES Act authority to cancel student debt. And that's an emergency authority that allows the Department of Education to cancel debt. The Supreme Court said, you know, that authority wasn't appropriate for this use case. So I really like to point that that was a narrow ruling. So what the president said, well, there are other legal authorities I can use to cancel that debt. And one of those was the Higher Education Act. And so using that authority to go through a formal rulemaking process within the Department of Education to provide relief to borrowers. And so we actually saw both last fall and part of this spring, we saw the Department of Education going through this formal rulemaking process to create a rule to provide more debt relief for student loan borrowers.
And so with that in mind, are you optimistic that this plan will hold up in court compared to the last attempt?
This is a really great question. And this is something where I'm like, you know, I wish I could see into the future. I think two big takeaways I would say from this plan is one, seeing this administration's commitment to providing debt relief. And, you know, we've seen this through many changes, through programmatic fixes that have given people access to debt relief through public service loan forgiveness, through income-driven repayment, seeing people have more affordable repayment plans, and then also the commitment to this larger promise to cancel debt. So we really do see that commitment to standing on those promises. As for the court, again, we saw the president had the authority to use the HEROES Act the first time, and so I can't speak to what we expect to see in terms of will the court do the right thing. We believe strongly that the president has the authority to do this. We also believe he had the authority to do it before, and so we really believe that the law is technically on its side in terms of using this formal process, but we have seen many, you know, partisan attacks and lawsuits aimed at trying to attack its relief. So that is a little bit of a wait and see. And so I know that's kind of like two answers in one, but we are hopeful that this will go through.
And so if the plan survives the likely legal battle ahead, how do you believe it would impact folks with student debt across the country?
This would be life-changing. I think one thing that's so important to note is that this could benefit upwards of 30 million people. So already when we think about that effect right across the country, that is huge. And then two, we could see upwards of another 4 million people see their debt wiped away entirely. And what we've seen in terms of stories we've heard, experiences of borrowers who have seen their debt canceled over these past 2 years is that, again, this is life-changing. People talk about, you know, the relief of this burden, feeling like they have the ability to really achieve the American dream, to be able to buy a home, to be able just to, you know, make ends meet every month because they don't have that student loan payment. But so much of the overwhelming sentiment we've heard from people is how life-changing this relief is. And I think also, too, for, you know, even people who will see partial relief, I think it's just really reinstilling this belief that it is possible to see this positive change coming from the administration, that we really can see a fix to this broken student loan system. And there is possibly, you know, efforts made at a solution to canceling student debt. This is one piece of it in terms of providing debt relief, but there's also still more work to be done in terms of thinking about access to higher education and this cost burden on so many households and so many families.
So before I let you go, is there anything else you'd like to share with our listeners?
I think one thing that's really important to note as these debt relief plans come out. So again, we're saying this proposal is going to provide relief for so many people. We'll see more details in hopefully the coming weeks and months. But also there's so many benefits, programs that people can benefit from now. For example, the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program for people who work in public service can get their debt canceled in entirety in 10 years. There have also been changes to income-driven repayment. And so I would encourage people to look up the income-driven repayment account adjustment where people are also getting credit for debt cancellation. And we've seen progress towards that. Or people who've struggled before with their student loan payments and may have been in default. There are also programs to help people get out of default and to get back in good standing on their debt. And so I'd really encourage people to go to studentaid.gov. That's the federal student aid website to look at some of these programs because we are seeing people, you know, get their debt canceled through these programs and pathways that are happening now, even as we await this larger plan.
Thank you again for agreeing to speak with me, Kat.
Thank you so much for having me, Faye. I really appreciate it.
That was Kat Welbeck, the Director of Advocacy and Civil Rights Council at the Student Borrower Protection Center.
You're listening to Handcrafted Local News on WORT. Stay with us. We've got a lot more stories for you coming up in the second half of the show. We follow up with the Wisconsin Uninstructed Campaign. We mark the anniversary of the Colfax Massacre, and we review two movies.
But now we'll take a quick break. Back in a flash.
Spring has sprung and vegetable seedlings are quickly growing. Fair Share CSA Coalition will get the conversation flowing. Tune in to the Access Hour on Monday, April 8th at 7 p.m. to hear about the hard work it takes to get local food on your plate. You'll learn lots about community-supported agriculture and vegetable farming. Hear stories from staff, farmers, and apprentices. Oh, how charming. We want to build resilient local food communities. Who knows? Maybe you'll learn an innovative farming technique, or you'll be signing up for a CSA next week. That's the Access Hour on Monday, April 8th at 7 p.m. on WORT Madison.
WORT thanks its listener sponsors and Five Nines, a locally owned cloud service provider of enterprise-level IT infrastructure consulting, hosting, and management services. On the web at fivenines.com. Phone number 512-1000.
Huge crowds of people across North America have watched the sky turn dark in the middle of the day, caused by a total eclipse of the sun. The Canadian province of Newfoundland and Labrador was the last place on land to see the phenomenon. Earlier, it swept across parts of the United States and Mexico. Nearly 30 people have gone on trial in connection with the Panama Papers scandal. The affair began with a huge leak of legal and financial documents 8 years ago. It highlighted how the rich and powerful used tax havens to hide their wealth. The White House has again urged Israel not to attack the overcrowded town of Rafah in southern Gaza. The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says a date has been set for the operation against Hamas, but he didn't reveal when. Israel says more than 400 aid trucks entered Gaza on Monday. It's the highest number in one day since the start of the war. Donald Trump has resisted calls from within his own party to back a total ban on abortion. He said it was up to individual US states to decide. His former Vice President Mike Pence called the announcement a slap in the face. Three Tanzanian soldiers have been killed during a mortar attack in the east of the Democratic Republic of Congo. They were members of a force deployed to halt worsening violence in the area. Ecuador's prison service says the former vice president, Jorge Glass, has been taken to hospital from a maximum security jail. Officials say he fell ill after refusing to eat. Mr. Glass was arrested last week when police stormed the Mexican embassy, prompting international condemnation. The electric vehicle manufacturer Tesla has reached a settlement in a long-running lawsuit over a man's death in California. Walter Huang was killed in 2018 when his Tesla car, which was on autopilot, veered off the road. Details of the settlement have not been revealed. BBC News.
Your time right now is 6:33, and you're listening to the live local news on WORT. I'm your host, Sam Swartz, here with my co-host, Rachel Fields. Thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Last Tuesday, 47,000 Wisconsinites voted uninstructed in the Democratic presidential primary. And this morning on the 8 o'clock buzz, host Brian Standing followed up with leadership at Listen to Wisconsin to hear what's ahead.
As the Israel-Hamas war now enters its seventh month with at least 40,000 dead and 2.5 million people displaced from their homes, it's worth remembering that the United States supplies 66% of Israel's military budget. Activists here in the U.S. distressed at the Biden administration's continued support for the Israeli war effort have encouraged voters to cast protest votes in state Democratic presidential primaries. Here in Wisconsin, the Listen to Wisconsin campaign urged voters to vote for uninstructed delegates in the April 2nd state presidential preference primary. The group had hoped to get at least 20,000 votes in a protest to send a message to the Biden campaign. They got more than twice that number, 48,000 votes for uninstructed delegates, nearly 9% of the total votes cast. So, what happens next? Joining us now to help answer that question is Listen to Wisconsin campaign director Rima Ahmad. Welcome to the 8 o'clock buzz.
Hi, good morning.
So tell us a little bit about what uninstructed delegates are. I mean, we understand if we cast votes for delegates for, you know, Joe Biden, that they're going to go to the Democratic convention in Chicago, and that's how they're going to cast the ballot. Are there actually delegates who have no direction at all, who can make up their own mind?
Yeah, so there are a number of states across the country, Wisconsin being one of them, where you can send delegates that can essentially make up their mind at the convention on which candidate that they will support and vote for. So in Wisconsin, that's called uninstructed. In other states, there's uncommitted, non-committed, no preference, and so forth. So we're very fortunate to have this democratic tool in our state.
So Listen to Wisconsin is only one of many campaigns going on around the country. You mentioned that they're called different things, but the general idea is the same. How many delegates are likely to show up in Chicago with the complete freedom to vote for whoever they choose?
Yeah, you know, right now I think the tally is up just under 30. So I want to say 25, 27. But the truth is the delegate strategy is one that is being led in a really beautiful and incredible way by the Uncommitted National Movement. But here in Wisconsin, our strategy was a little different. You know, we have the opportunity with uninstructed to get delegates, but in a place like Wisconsin, where our elections are razor thin, decided by less than 1% in the last couple presidential election cycles, we knew that our lever of power was the sheer number of votes we could get, especially in a primary election where at the top of the ticket, there otherwise isn't a challenge. And so, our goal was always about turning out the margin of victory to be able to push our administration towards policy change and less about delegates going to the DNC.
So what happens now, both from the Wisconsin standpoint and from the sort of the national uncommitted standpoint? You've done far better than you expected. You've sent a pretty clear message that there's a number of people who are unhappy with the current presidential, Democratic presidential, the presumptive nominee, Joe Biden. Is there a dialogue going on between Listen to Wisconsin and the Biden campaign? And are there particular platform changes or immediate action from the Biden administration you would like to see happen that would satisfy your demands?
Certainly. I mean, well, I just want to note that 48,162 votes from for uninstructed within the Democratic presidential primary is a clear message. Like you said at the top of this call, more than double the margin of victory that Biden won Wisconsin by in 2020. And the demand is clear that without an immediate and permanent ceasefire and an end to military aid to Israel, his support among Wisconsin Democrats is insufficient to win re-election in November. And so we're urging the president to heed this message. This message is coming out of not only Wisconsin, again, a critical state for the pathway to the presidency in November. We were the tipping point state last time around. We will likely be so again this year. But he's received this message from a majority of Americans that are saying loud and clear that Gaza needs a permanent ceasefire and you, this administration, must impose it by ending military funding. And I'll just say a little bit more that Wisconsin voters don't want billions of our tax dollars going to ending life abroad. Our voters want, we are voters of conscience who believe that wherever you come from and whatever you look like, we all deserve safety, freedom, and dignity, and we will not stand for genocide. So I can't emphasize enough just how important it is that because we were able to turn out not simply the margin of victory, but again, more than double that, which, by the way, is historic, and no other one of these states that have run protest vote campaigns has the protest vote reached the margin of victory. And we're just so fortunate that we were able to accomplish that in Wisconsin, despite the rain and the sleet and the snow, as folks may remember Election Day was last week. But again, there's just a resounding message coming from the very base that mobilized for the Biden-Harris ticket in 2020 saying, listen to us, heed our calls. We want to support life. We want to save lives, and in the process, save democracy.
So with the election in the rear view and the success behind that, what is Listen to Wisconsin focusing on now?
Well, importantly, this campaign came out of some incredible organizing happening through a broad coalition of grassroots organizations all across the state, organizations that represent different faiths and backgrounds. Different experiences, all living here in Wisconsin. And so those organizations are going to continue to organize. We're going to continue to share with our elected officials, both locally, statewide, and certainly going all the way up to the top of this administration, that you cannot guarantee our votes, that we need to see policy change if we stand a chance of securing Wisconsin and saving democracy against fascism later on this year in November. And so we will continue to amplify that message. We know that there are community members that will be trying to deliver that message as Biden is coming into the state. And we are prepared to, you know, there are folks within our membership that are already hoping to be delegates to run as Biden delegates going into the DNC and to continue to take this message from Wisconsin Democrats, by the way. The vote was firmly on the Democratic ticket, mobilizing a base of voters who have previously supported this administration and came out to vote in 2020 as such, to say, we need you to pay attention to us right now because we do want to save lives and we want to save democracy. And that's going to require some drastic policy changes on the part of this administration with regards to Gaza.
Have you had any direct contact with the Biden campaign or with the Biden administration?
No.
Have you attempted to get in touch with them?
We have not made a direct attempt beyond sending a very clear message on Election Day last week that we are the margin of victory in the state. And to be able to turn that out again in a primary election with expected, what we were going into the election was expecting low voter turnout. And what we saw is an incredible surge of voters from all across the state saying, we are, now I'll borrow Michigan's language, right? We are not committed to how this administration is moving forward when it comes to handling Gaza. And we want to save lives. We want to save lives. We want this administration to take this call seriously because we know what's at stake later on this year in November. And only drastic changes in our policy will result in any type of opportunity for folks to turn around and vote in November.
Are you planning a activist presence at any of the president's appearances?
We are not directly planning stuff, but I do know that different community grassroots groups are indeed going to be present and you know, expressing their voices as the president comes to town.
And tell us about any communication or coordination you have with some of these campaigns going on in other states. How much contact do you have, say, with folks in, say, Michigan or Minnesota?
Yeah, you know, it's really beautiful. As a Midwesterner through and through, it's been beautiful to see just our neighbors show up as well. You know, so first being inspired by what happened in Michigan, and then a week later seeing our neighbors in Minnesota turn out, it put a lot of pressure on us in Wisconsin to also, you know, take the baton and make a really good showing for this protest vote. And I'll say that we have been in communication with some of the organizers in Michigan and in Minnesota. Indeed, some of those organizers joined us in Milwaukee when we had our official campaign launch on March 19th, the first day of early voting. And so it was beautiful to actually make this connection that so many of our communities across this region are saying loud and clear that, you know, we want to save lives, we want to save democracy, and it's going to take drastic policy changes with regards to Gaza and the ongoing genocide in order for us to see that happen. But materially, some of the same volunteer infrastructure that came out of the incredible efforts in Michigan, they offered to us here in Wisconsin, and we said, thank you. We will gladly use some of these volunteers, help us to spread the word, to make sure that more and more of our neighbors out here in the state know about this option, because uninstructed is a little obscure. Even the fact that it's called uninstructed and not something like uncommitted, which, you know, had gained a lot of notoriety in the last couple months. You know, folks were like, wait, is this our version of uncommitted? And we were able to say, yes, it is. But being able to leverage that volunteer base was such an asset to helping us reach as many of our community members as possible all across the state and let them know that we had this opportunity to voice our anti-war, pro-peace message to this administration and hopefully move Biden towards the type of policy changes we need to save lives and save democracy later this year.
Now, in recent weeks, we've seen the Biden administration take a somewhat tougher stance on Israel. The killing of aid workers recently seems to have change some of the Biden administration's approach to Israel. We're hearing out of Cairo now that there may be some progress on a temporary ceasefire. Are these enough, or do you need to see more?
We absolutely need to see more. I think these words ring hollow when at the same time that we are, you know, this administration is talking about wanting to send more humanitarian aid, or the fact that they are angry with Israel's or Netanyahu's response, that this administration, that Biden is pushing for $18 billion in fighter jets going to Israel. This is, there is such incredible dissonance here that it is, it's startling. So no, everything that has happened to date rings hollow when every single day upwards of 60 children are essentially killed on our dime. This is, it is untenable. So anything short of demanding a permanent ceasefire through ending military aid to Israel will not suffice for our pro-peace, anti-war voters.
All right. We've been speaking with Listen to Wisconsin campaign manager Rema Ahmad. Thank you so much for joining us on the 8 o'clock buzz.
Thank you so much.
The time right now is 6:46 p.m., and you're listening to the live local news on WORT.
This Saturday, April 13th, is the anniversary of the Colfax Massacre in Louisiana. In 1873, at least 150 African Americans were killed by white supremacists. It was the largest single-day racially motivated slaughter during the Reconstruction era. The massacre led to the end of Reconstruction and started the long reign of Jim Crow. Feature contributor Harry Richardson has the story.
For Joe Hill and Cesar Chavez, who fought in their own time, for our brothers and our sisters up and down that picket line, for the unnamed and unnumbered who struggle brave and long, for the Union men and women standing up and standing strong.
This Saturday, April 13th, is the anniversary of the Colfax Massacre in Louisiana. Up to 150 African Americans were killed on Easter Sunday, 1873. It was the bloodiest single instance of racial carnage in the Reconstruction era, according to historian Eric Foner. The massacre led to the end of Reconstruction and the rise of Jim Crow across the South. It followed the onset of the Panic of 1873, the worst depression in U.S. history up to that time. The year before the Panic started, in 1872, fall elections had allowed Republicans to take charge of the Louisiana legislature and the governorship, but the Democrats also declared victory and formed a rival legislature and governor. There were disputed local elections all over the state, and each side had their own militia. The Republicans had the official National Guard, which included blacks and whites, with some African Americans in leadership roles. The Democrats had a militia filled with white supremacists. They resisted efforts of black people to buy land to keep blacks dependent on whites. Violence and threats of violence spread across the state. The Colfax Massacre was the most notorious instance. Near Easter time, African-American families had converged on the courthouse at the county seat of Colfax after violent attacks on the community. 300 white supremacist troops, led by a Confederate veteran, C.C. Nash, menaced the town and prepared for an assault. Black militiamen tried to shore up the courthouse defenses. They also sent two representatives to New Orleans to beg for help. On Easter Sunday, Nash demanded those in the courthouse surrender. Union Army veterans William Ward and Levin Allen, commanding the courthouse defenses, refused, and Nash's forces launched a brutal attack. The black militiamen courageously held their positions until Nash's forces brought in a cannon, overwhelming the defenders. The white separatists burned down the courthouse, killing those inside, slaughtering those who fled, and executing survivors taken prisoner. Over 60 black militiamen were murdered, or possibly twice that many, having been slowed by rival forces who blocked access to steamboats. The state's National Guard did not arrive until the next day. Later, federal troops arrived, rounding up 97 suspects and charging them with conspiracy under the 1870-1871 Enforcement Acts, but only 9 went to trial, Despite searing testimony of survivors, only three were convicted. Those convictions were overturned in 1874 by the U.S. Supreme Court in the United States versus Cruikshank, effectively leaving the enforcement of the rights of African Americans up to the individual states. Historian James K. Hoagie noted the decision fanned the flames ignited by the spark of Colfax into a wildfire blaze of paramilitary mobilization across Louisiana. The White League's 14,000 members forced Republicans from office and terrorized black communities. Similar efforts spread throughout the southern states. The federal elections of 1876 were characterized by unprecedented levels of racially motivated voter fraud by white southern Democrats who engaged in ballot stuffing and threatening blacks with violence if they dared vote. Through a mixture of corruption, intimidation, and outright violence, Democrat Samuel Tilden won a plurality of states in the Deep South. It was one of the nation's closest elections, but Tilden ceded the presidency to Republican Rutherford B. Hayes in exchange for removal of all federal troops from the South, effectively ending Reconstruction. Also, Republicans lost their large congressional majority, ushering in over 20 years of political gridlock. In 1920, a monument was unveiled in the city's cemetery. It honored the three white men killed, heroes who fell in the Colfax riot fighting for white supremacy, it said. In 1950, Louisiana put up a highway marker describing the massacre as a riot at the end of carpetbag misrule in the South. But in 2008, on the 135th anniversary of the massacre, an interracial group commemorated the tragedy by laying flowers where some of the victims had died and holding a forum discussing the history of the massacre. And in 2021, the state highway marker was removed. Finally, on April 13, 2023, the 150th anniversary of the Colfax Massacre, the removed marker was replaced by a 7-foot granite monument that lists 57 black people confirmed to have been killed in the massacre. The marker also contains artwork about the experience of black people during Reconstruction. And that is our story for today. For the past is the past, I'm Harry Richardson.
It's 6:52 p.m. your time right now, and you're listening to the live local news on WORT.
Today, feature contributor Harry Richardson reviews two anti-war documentary classics showing on campus. They're part of the Wisconsin Historical Society's event series, Waging Peace in Vietnam, U.S. Soldiers and Veterans Who Opposed the War. Sir No Sir is about the soldiers' movement against the war, and The War at Home is about the anti-war movement in Madison.
During the Vietnam War, an anti-war movement emerged that altered the course of history. This movement didn't take place on college campuses, but in barracks and on ships. It flourished in Army stockades, Navy brigs, and the dingy towns that surrounded military bases.
That was a clip from the trailer for Sir, No Sir, written and directed by David Zeger. This is a great documentary about the GI movement against the war in Vietnam. The movie is showing Wednesday at 7 p.m. as part of the Waging Peace in Vietnam, U.S. Soldiers and Veterans Who Opposed the War. The series is taking place over several days at the Wisconsin Historical Society on the UW campus. The movie came out in 2005. The film is about active duty personnel who opposed the war and how that movement grew. It views the Tet Offensive in 1968 as the turning point. Tet, though militarily a failure, was a tactical victory. It showed the widespread support for the Vietnamese revolutionary fighters among ordinary people, the determination of the regular Vietnamese Army of the North, and the weakness of the American propped-up South Vietnamese Army. As movie critic Roger Ebert put it when the documentary came out, troop morale ebbed lower, the war seemed lost, and a protest movement encompassed active-duty troops, coffee houses near bases in America, underground GI newspapers, and a modern underground railway that helped soldiers desert and move to Canada. According to the Pentagon's own figures, there were 500,000 desertions during Vietnam. Zeger, the director, was an anti-war activist working at a GI coffee house. He used good archival footage, music of the day, and some current interviews with a number of vets and peace activists like Jane Fonda. The doc shows how efforts starting out small with a coffee house here, an underground military base paper there. There were over 1,400 documented cases of fragging where soldiers used fragmentation grenades to kill officers and or non-commissioned officers. NCOs were senior enlisted people who viewed the military as a career and were derisively known as lifers. Eventually, entire military units refused to fight. Some units brought in to help control the 1968 Chicago Democratic Convention riots were not used because they were not considered reliable enough. He makes a convincing case that the military came close to imploding, not just in Vietnam, but around the world and in the U.S. Sir, No Sir will be followed by a Q&A with the director, David Zeger, moderated by Judy Karofsky, an affordable housing advocate. To hear more from the director, check out his interview in the WORT archive with Thursday's APA host, Alan Ruff. Up next, another classic documentary showing at the program.
Dow was manufacturing napalm. And Dow Chemical recruited professional people from the campus for careers in their various operations.
That was a clip from the trailer for The War at Home, directed by Glenn Silber and Barry Alexander Brown. The 1979 Academy Award-nominated film will be showing tomorrow at 7 p.m. at the Wisconsin Historical Society on the UW campus. Afterwards, there will be a Q&A with Silber, moderated by former mayor Paul Soglin. For the uninitiated, The War at Home chronicles the story of Madison's anti-war movement from its small first actions in 1963 to the Dow riots to the 1970s Sterling Hall bombing to the war's end in 1973. Silber talked about making the film during one of the events around the 40th anniversary showing of the film on October 13, 2019. At the Orpheum Theater. The occasion was a benefit for the Progressive magazine. Silber explained how he decided to do a film about the anti-war movement with Madison as a focal point. He talked about haunting the Wisconsin Historical Society archives and worrying about the history being lost. He was there when a local TV station donated massive archival footage of the period. It was filthy from being stored in a chicken coop for years. The Society gave Silber and Brown access to the material in exchange for helping to catalog. All that footage was put to good use in the documentary. The documentary starts with Madison being voted the best place to live in America, an idealized, quiet American city in the heart of the Midwest. The first small anti-war protest featured young men in suits and women in dresses. The film has over 20 interviews with people who were there. The best known today would be Paul Soglin. But there were also interviews with Kenny Mate from the underground paper Takeover, the local head of the SDS, and women activists as well. So, two fine films showing this week as part of Waging Peace, plus Hunting in a Time of War about Native American soldiers Sunday, April 21st at the Wisconsin Historical Society. There'll be an intro and Q&A by attorney Samantha Skenador with film director Samantha Farinelli, which I hope to review in the future. For WRT's Monday Movie Review, I'm Harry Richardson.
And that does it for our show. Thanks for listening to WORT's Live Local News at 6. Special thanks to feature contributors Harry Richardson, Brian Standing of the 8 o'clock Buzz, and Mike Moen of Wisconsin News Connection. Thanks also to Nicholas Leet for technical production and Bill Kingsbury for web production. Victor Calzoni engineered the show tonight, Faye Parks produced this newscast, and Shally Pittman is the news director at WORT. I'm your host, Sam Swartz.
And I'm your host, Rachel Fields. Stay up to date with the WORT Local News Podcast. Subscribe on iTunes Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever else you listen. Up next is the most freeform show on your radio dial, The Access Hour. Have a great night.
And you are listening to WORT 89.9 FM, Madison.
Hey! What are you trying to do? You ruined my record, man! I just bought it!
Did you realize this year's Record Store Day is April 20th, also known as 420? We here at WORT are certainly aware, and as a matter of fact, we're throwing a party at the Crystal Corner Bar with two great local bands, Iftikhar and the Earthlings, supplemented by sets from WORT DJs, Julia McAnley from Her Infinite Variety, Brian Hirsch from Green Morning Radio, and New Phone Rick of XL290 Live Music Radio Hour. So we'll see you at the Crystal Corner, Saturday, April 20th, for a Record Store Day and 420 celebration with Iftikhar, the Earthlings, and WORT DJs.
Welcome to the Access Hour, where each week WORT offers you the opportunity to fly your program over the radio. The Access Hour is WORT's commitment to community access to the airwaves. For this hour, we have turned the airwaves over to a member of the public. The views expressed on the Access Hour do not represent the views of the station, its staff, programmers, or the board of directors. We'd like this show to be as unpredictable as possible, so we need your creative ideas. It's a fair trade. You give us what you've got, and we give you the facilities and any help you need to get your program airborne. So let your mind wander and wonder. And when the inspiration for some pretty good radio glows with a clear, bright light, get in touch. Just go to WORTFM.org and look on the left side for